Okay, I want to put this caveat in there as well, because several of you have expressed this to me, that what we have, the angle we've gone through in just three classes has already kind of like shaking some of you up. And I'm sensitive to that. I understand that. But we're still laying down the foundation. So I know what a lot of you are feeling right now is maybe, and some of you may be like, I'm not feeling really anything. That's fine. But some of you may be feeling like everything that I'm saying is tearing down what you've always learned. And so with the fear in this process comes whenever you start to think, not does this make sense? You start to think, when everything gets torn down, what is left? And so you start to shake and you start to fear. And normally what happens then is that you'll eventually will turn me off if you fear too much and too long. You'll turn me off and just cling on what you've heard before. And that is an option. You can do that. However, my challenge to you would be is this. Let everything be torn down and let's build it up together. And let's just see, whenever you get to the end of it, then let's critique it. But if everything so far is making sense as we're putting each of these pieces of the puzzle together, then allow the puzzle to develop before you scrap it and just hold on to the picture you've had from before. Allow it to build back up. Right now what we're doing is we're clearing the ground. I said these first couple of weeks, we're clearing it, we're sweeping the floor, we're laying down a new foundation from which we will build something. But right now, we need to keep sweeping the floor. So if you're in the moment where you're a little bit afraid, a little bit nervous where this is headed, a little bit upset, hey, just relax. Just relax. Let's just wait till we get to the end of the track before you're upset with where we've ended up. Make sense? Cool? Okay, I understand this. Book of Revelations. I don't know if I've said this to you guys before, but I say this a lot. I always say, if you want to get an earful or an eyeful, you talk about somebody's money, their medicine, or their millennial view. You mess with somebody's money, they're going to either pop you in the eye or they're just going to chew you out. You mess with somebody's medicine, hello, just go to Walgreens and stand there for 30 minutes. Those people get chewed out all the time. You mess with somebody's millennial view, yeah, you'll get called quite a few little names. But if we can all just relax and just move this together, it'll be fine, okay? So where have we been so far? What have we talked about? We've only had three class periods, but it feels like we've gone a long way, right? Ginry, last class. Talked about the old Ginry. What about it? What about Revelation's genres? Ooh, I don't think I have the right one up there. Yeah, that's not... I forgot to change... Oh, I know what I did. Yeah, that's supposed to say symbols. And yeah, I forgot to change that word. Everything else is going to be cool. Sorry! Oh man, I give you permission to scratch out what you've written. Nothing else will be like that. Okay, we're not still talking about genre. We're talking about symbols, and we're even going to talk about sources some today. But what have we talked about so far? You said genre. What in particular have we talked about with Revelation genres?
Ask the right question.
Mm-hmm. They help us ask the right questions. Exactly. What are the three genres we identified of Revelation? The epistolary, which is letters. Prophetic, exactly. Which is that? How do we define prophetic? Or what are we?
Future.
Awesome. Get out of my class. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, that is not what we define. What did we define it as, though? What's that? Yes. What God? What? Yes. Who God is? What God desires? Hello. And what God demands from us? Exactly. That's what. And does that sometimes involve prediction? Absolutely. Does it always? Less than 83% of the time. Okay? All right. Third one. Apocalyptic. How do we define apocalyptic?
It is a revelation from a transcendent reality. About transcendent realities often communicated by otherworldly beings with a great
amount of symbolism.
Comfort and exhort oppressed people.
Yes. Yeah, off the top of your head, that sounds awesome. Yes, absolutely. It is a revelation of transcendent realities, oftentimes communicated by otherworldly beings with a great amount of symbolism to oppressed people to comfort and exhort them. Absolutely. Absolutely. And the reason why that is important is why. This even goes to one of the questions that was answered at the end. And I think it was by you, Greg, that asked the question about, are there other apocalypses outside of the Jews, like in Romans? And I was thinking about it later, and I was like, hello? Not to you, to me. Because my answer was not that I can think of, but duh, no. Because the genre in and of itself the genre in and of itself is coming out from oppressed people. Here's the question. If you are living in dominance as the rulers of Rome, you don't need to envision another world. Because the world you're living in is exactly what you want. But if you are the oppressed people in a kingdom, another world is all you can hold on to. So, you are not going to find many apocalypses, if any, written from the top down. 9 times out of 10, matter of fact, I can't think of one. I don't know one that's not written from the bottom up. It's just kind of the way it works. Yes?
I mean, for the Romans, wouldn't their eschatology be more just the present? And that, I mean, Pax Romana.
Absolutely.
Emperors, I mean, it is already inaugurated.
Right. It is not that they do not have an eschatology. It's that they don't write an apocalyptic literature. Because the function of the genre is for more oppressed people. Eschatology is something that everybody functions off of in order to make sense of life. And their eschatology would not just be Pax Romana, but it'd be Roma Eternia. The eternality of Rome. The fact that Rome, matter of fact, Steve Friesen in his book, The Imperial Cults and the Apocalypse of John, in his last chapter or two, he makes the introduction of that. He argues that the key thing for the reason why Revelation was written in the apocalyptic genre targeting eschatology is because that was the weakest point of Rome, of Rome's overall worldview. The way in which the key components that they have put into place, the one thing that they did not have a good explanation for was the destiny of Rome. They described it as the eternality of Rome, but the problem is that we have just gone through a civil war where internally and externally, there were all kinds of factors showing that Rome could crumble like this. And then after that, you still want to be talking about the eternality of Rome? Just 25 years earlier, we almost saw it all collapse. How can I now describe it as eternal? So he says that he thinks it's very strategic that Revelation's right on eschatology because that's the weakest point of Rome's overall worldview, which I agree with, and I hope to develop further. But anyway, that's a little bit off topic. But it's important to understand why this is developing in and of itself. What else have we talked about? Not just Ginnery, but the others, two other elements we focused on. Historical background, exactly. What is the one word that we can use to summarize the historical setting of the book of Revelation?
Conflict.
Conflict, conflict, conflict. And how do we define conflict? When two kingdoms or two people try to occupy the exact same space at the exact same time. Exactly. And from this, we have the context, which is what we talked about in the very first class, starting to develop from which we can wrestle with the actual text. Okay? Now we know where we've been, let's move forward. Symbols! Why am I going to start talking about symbols? Well, we'll get to that question in a bit. What? Unless you have an answer right away.
Because there are tons of them.
Because there's tons of them. We'll get to that. That is a good point.
Yeah, right.
But before we get to there's tons of them, let's do this. Let's ask, or let me make this point. Oh my goodness. Okay. I just didn't know if that one was going to end. Somebody's going to have the reset button. Okay. I've heard it said that a picture is worth 1,000 words, which says something about symbols. What do you think about that statement in and of itself? Do you agree, disagree? How do you reflect on it? Symbols or a picture is worth 1,000 words.
Depends on what the picture is.
Okay.
Depends on who's looking at it.
Okay. Ooh, now that's interesting. Because I somewhat agree with depends on what the picture is. I somewhat agree. But I really, the reason why I somewhat agree is because of the follow-up comment. Because it depends on who's looking at it. Because bottom line is, this picture, you may only have 15 words to say something about it. But if you started looking at the different images that are actually involved in this picture, all of us, and it depends on which eyes you're looking through. As a matter of fact, if you're a Russian looking through this, totally different image. Because this is actually not just Michael the Archangel. They actually have pictures of this throughout Russia. That this is one of their patron saints, and it's symbolizing his victory over the dictatorship of the time. So it really does depend on who's looking at it, right? What I really want us to get at the outset, though, is this. Symbols have power. Oh, my, symbols have power. People can just say that they hate us, or we'll have people say, we hate America. Okay, well, whatever. But that is much different than doing this. Why would somebody do this? Why would people stand in a street, hold up a piece of fabric, and light it on fire? Big deal. Or is it? What are they doing? Yeah, they're burning the flag, but what they're interacting with something symbolic. Yes, they are taking something that is sacred to the people they are opposing, and they are desecrating it on purpose to make a statement that is bigger than just saying, I don't like America. It's much bigger than that. Why? Because they're taking the flag that symbolizes all that America stands for, and they're burning it. This is something that does not just attack the mind, it attacks the heart. Right? That's what all symbols do. And symbols have power that can resonate through ripple effects that we can't even gauge. Because even if you look at the mass amount of people there, even the fact that they're all gathered, something starts happening of a synergy within that moment. Because things that are occurring, even verbally, take on a whole new form when they're in a setting like this. Right? Because symbols have power. But it does depend on who's looking at it. Because frankly, one of them would be like so. Where if you had a veteran that, die hard, he bleeds red, white, and blue, it would mean something different to him. His words would even be different. But let me build on this. Symbols have power, the power of symbols. What do you see here? Describe to me.
Zion and you.
Okay, Zion and me. What else?
Dad and his son.
Cincinnati Bible College shirt, even though I've never actually stepped foot on that campus before. But they gave me a free shirt, and it was a cool one, so I wore it. He's wearing, maybe a Snuggie or something, yeah. Well, it kind of looks like that, yeah.
Your hair is much shorter.
My hair is much shorter, yes, that is true.
There is joy on your face.
There is joy on my face.
And maybe mild hair.
On his face or my own. He's like, oh my gosh. Let me describe to you what I see. Because it's different for me. I just got back from being 27 days away walking through the seven cities of Revelation. This is the first time that I've been able to see my son since I've gotten back. And what he is wearing is a robe that I got from him in Turkey. And it's a little dog that goes over, that has a... He pulls it up and it's got a little dog tongue that hangs out. So in this picture, whenever I look at it, yes, it is a dad with his son. It is some joy. But for me, it elicits different emotions. Because the pain of being away from my son for that long is beyond words. But whenever I see this picture, it starts to conjure somewhat of backup for me. Why? Because even pictures are symbols. Pictures are symbols. They point to something that is beyond what they're actually depicting. Always. Let me give you another one. What do you see here?
Crazy beard coming.
My crazy beard coming forward. Goatee, sideburns. Yes, it's trying to grab my upper lip, okay? What's that? See, it helps to know a little bit about my family. Because this picture would just be look like a dad, or maybe someone holding a baby. But if you look at the timestamp at the bottom right, that is the date of my daughter's birth. And this is the very first time I'm holding her. So although it can be just a mundane picture, although it can mean virtually nothing to you, for me, this is sacred. This is different. Talking negatively about this picture impacts me because of what it means to me. Because that's my daughter, my only daughter. And that's the very first time I'm holding her. The very first time that she is feeling the arms of somebody that will get to hold her for the rest of her life. Or at least mine. Symbols are powerful. And they do more than merely communicate to something in our minds. They connect to something deeper. And whenever you're filled with an entire book of symbols, you start to realize that you need more context. Where are we? Or what is this? Describe this to me. What's going on?
The gates of heaven are closed on someone.
Okay, first of all, let's define what you said. The very first thing you said, the very first thing Annie said, the very first thing that Annie said was, the gates of heaven are closed on someone. Here's my question. How do you know we're in heaven?
Clouds.
Oh. Okay. Natalia, is that normal symbols from where you're from, clouds like this being heaven?
Yeah, somewhat. Yeah.
kind of. Because I've found other places that I've been, like Prague, Czech Republic, whenever I tried to describe to them this, had no idea what I was talking about. What do you mean clouds in heaven? You know, pearly gates. What? It doesn't make any sense to them. Why?
Different symbols.
Yeah. They picture heaven differently. Now you're going to ask me, how do they picture it? I don't know, because I was such in shock, I didn't really know how to progress from there. But let's continue to develop this. What if I was going to make a caption for this, what would I make it? Ah, another piece to the puzzle comes into play. Colonel Sanders, and what is he saying? Why? Oh yeah, because there's chickens decorating the pearly gates. And if you look at the caption, Colonel Sanders at the pearly gates, he's in a world of trouble, right? KFC, that is universal. All of this is communicated with, you didn't even need this. You only needed the two words right there. And you understood what was happening. Why? Symbols. Symbols communicate to you on a different level. It even elicits a chuckle out of you. It even elicits a reaction of humor. Even though it was only two words. Why?
Even the words have like a meaning behind them?
Yes, because even though everything adds to the full image. And it's not just mere surface level data that you're interacting with. It's the power of symbols that actually moves the surface level data to something deeper. Okay? This is how symbols function. So why all of this talk of symbols in the book of Revelation? I'm going to make a statement, and this is one of the number one reasons why. This is, some people will claim this is audacious, but, well, it's true. In the book of Revelation, every number, every color, every animal, every piece of furniture, everything symbolizes something else. Every number, every color, every animal, every piece of furniture, every weather pattern, every piece of clothing or lack thereof. As a matter of fact, one of the inductive studies that you guys are allowed to do is on clothing. One of my friends did a paper in Revelation class before called The Theology of Nudity. And the reason why is because if you trace clothing in Revelation or people that are not clothed in Revelation, it says something about which side of the battle they're on. Clothing means something. To the church in Sardis, he says, some of you have soiled your clothing. What does that mean? Or the harlot in Revelation chapter 17 is dressed in these purple robes very scantily. What does that mean? Or Jesus in Revelation chapter 16 verse 15 says, behold, I am coming soon, so make sure you are fully clothed. Revelation chapter 6, to the martyrs underneath the altar. They say, how long until you avenge our blood? And what does God do? Gives them some robes. Revelation chapter 7, you see a multitude, and they are clothed in heaven with what? White robes. What you wear in Revelation matters. Why? Because every number, every color, every animal, every piece of furniture symbolizes something. Some people say, well, what about the seven churches? Those are seven literal churches. Yeah, but what do I do about Hierapolis and Colossae? Right? Why didn't he have those two? We know there were churches there. Because the number seven was more important. We'll talk about that number is just here in a bit. Actually, let's talk about numbers some more. Numbers are very important when it comes to symbolism in Revelation. And this is not foreign to our culture. Matter of fact, those of you that have been to the New York trips, you can even vouch for me on this. But I've traveled enough where this is very true in our society. This is a normal occurrence in our American context. Sorry, my mind's here, but it's not here. You're going up into the 17th floor of a building, very tall skyscraper, and you get into the elevator, and what do you notice? Huh. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, 17. Why?
Superstition.
Why? Yeah, superstition based on what? The number 13 stands for something bigger than its actual numerical value in our society, doesn't it? Even Friday the 13th now. If you have Friday the 13th, what happens? Well, man, on pretty much every channel, you're going to find some sort of slasher movie. Right? Because 13 is bad, but you combine it with Friday and it's even worse. in our society. Numbers have symbolic meaning in our society. What if I would say to you 9/11? What? What does that mean? Twin Towers? Because if I say that in some other context, they would just look at me and say, you forgot 10. That's all they would say. Why? Because in our society, the numbers mean something. But in other societies, that's not universal. There aren't people overseas that whenever you say the words 9/11, it impacts them deeply. But what's weird is, even to this day, I can remember exactly where I was on this campus whenever I realized something was happening. Walking up in between my classes, going up the hill right here, going past Willie, seeing everybody pouring in there, walking in and hearing that a bomb had hit the buildings, had exploded. And then later on that afternoon, a couple hours later, finding out it was planned. I remember it very clearly. Why? Because that's a part of who we are. That's our context. And now those numbers put together mean something different. And yet, I will venture to say this, that 150 years from now, people won't look at those numbers, even in our country, the same way. The same way that a lot of us in here can't even give us the date of Pearl Harbor, although that was very similar. You see what I mean? Numbers take on symbolic meanings in certain contexts and at certain times. If I was in Russia and I sent someone 8 flowers, they would flip. Flip! Because if I send them an even number, it's me telling them that they're going to die soon.
So
numbers mean stuff in different cultures.
A dozen roses is a bad idea.
Yeah, it's a bad idea. A dozen roses, don't do it. Give them 13. Hey, splitting it over. The point is this. It should not shock us that in the Jewish culture, numbers are symbolic for other things. It shouldn't shock us. We do it in our culture. It's all across the world. And that's why when we come to numbers like the number 7 in the book of Revelation, we have to read it differently. Where in the Bible do we find the number 7 most significantly for the very first time? Yes, hello. Chapter 1 of the entire Bible. Genesis 1. What happens there? Creation. But, God created everything in 6 days. So why did he have to have the 7th?
To enjoy one of the rest.
Maybe.
Because it wasn't complete without rest.
Ooh, I love the word you used there. Because the Jews agreed with that. Exactly what you said there. It wasn't complete without rest. Therefore, in Jewish understanding, the number 7 came to be known as the number for completeness. Not perfection, completeness, totality. Therefore, every time you see the number 7 in Jewish literature, which Revelation is, it is symbolizing completeness. Where in Revelation do we see the number 7?
Everywhere.
Give me some.
Church.
7 churches. Where else?
7 stars.
7 lampstands. 7 thunders. 7 stars. 7 trumpets. 7 seals. 7 bowls. 7 horns. It's everywhere. So let's take it. Whenever it comes to the 7 seals, why 7? Because it's describing the completeness of the judgment. That's why it takes us to the end of the world. That's why the trumpets takes us to the end of the world. That's why the bowls takes us to the end of the world as well. It's completeness. Whenever he's talking about horns, you also have to understand that the symbol for horn in Jewish literature is for power. Daniel chapter 9 gives us the idea of this with the little horn coming up in power. Power. And so if you have 7 horns on something, what does that mean?
Power.
Complete power. Complete power. I find it very interesting. Let me also throw this out there. This is for the chronology people. What do we do with the 7 thunders? If Revelation is a chronological roadmap for the future, the 7 thunders aren't even allowed to be written down, so we have an incomplete chronology. Right? Chapter 10 occurs. He sees 7 thunders, begins to write them, and what happens? The voice from heaven says, do not write down what you just heard. And he doesn't. So if we're trying to lay out a chronological roadmap, we've got a major problem because one of our 7s is incomplete. But why does that exist? Why does the 7 thunders exist?
Is there 7 sevens?
No, but there's 4. 4 sevens. A 7 seals, 7 trumpets, 7 bowls, 7 thunders. 4 is another number for completion. See what's happening here? The reason why seven thunders is necessary to mention, but he doesn't need to elaborate it on, is because the number four is more important than the actual revelation of the thunders. You following me? Every number that we interact with in Revelation, every number, is within this context, this genre of symbolism. And it's trying to communicate something deeper. For example, the number 10 is also a number for completeness. I know what you're thinking. Whoa, all these completeness numbers. Yeah, I know. And usually every one of them has a little of a nuance to them. For example, the number 4 a lot of times is attached to the earth. Four corners of the earth you see in Revelation chapter 7. The entire earth, complete earth. That's what it's trying to communicate. But the number 10. To the church in Smyrna, chapter 2, you guys can flip there. Church in Smyrna, if you want. Verse 10, that's ironic. Anyway, says, "Do not be afraid of what you're about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Here's my question. Is Jesus counting the amount of days they'll actually suffer persecution? Or is he saying something bigger? If you're a Jew, where in the Old Testament can you remember a time period of testing and even of persecution within testing that lasted for 10 days that could infuse what he just said there with some deeper meaning? Daniel, chapter 1. The Jewish people are pulled out into exile, correct? Under Babylon. Daniel is one of the people that's gone there, and who else has gone with him? The people that get renamed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, correct? And they are there at the very beginning in chapter 1. They are told that they have to eat at the king's table, but they also have to eat the meat, things that they weren't not allowed to eat. And what do they ask? They say, instead, let us eat our diet and test us for 10 days. And if we succeed, or if at the end of 10 days, we are stronger and more healthy, then let us just go by our own diet. If not, then we will obey yours. And what ended up happening? At the end of the 10 day of testing, what happened? They were stronger. And the text even says they were more wise than all the other people that were within their particular, the wise men of the that they were being trained to be. 10. So what does 10 then symbolize in the story of Israel? A period of testing, and I'm talking about in the context of Smyrna, because it is completeness as well, but a complete period of testing in which, even though you are exiles in a different empire, you will be proven to be the true people of God. So whenever he looks at the church of Smyrna and he says, you will be tested for 10 days, they look at it and they say, and we will be victorious. So much bigger than just counting days. Because this isn't just like Revelation was written in a vacuum. It's continuing an entire story. A story that began in the garden in Genesis 1 and will end in the garden in Revelation chapter 22. It is riding in a stream of an ocean that's been going for quite a while. Therefore, he is not putting in there things by accident. Therefore, he doesn't count that there are 10 horns on the dragon by accident. Why? Because he's saying there is a complete reality to its power. It can devour people that are dedicated to God. Matter of fact, we'll even talk about how even the number 666, symbolic. Even the number 1,000 is symbolic. Why? Every number in Revelation is symbolic. 1,260 days. Is he counting days? This is interesting. 1,260 days. What would that be in months? How many months? No. 42 months. Right?
Yes.
How many years is that? Ooh, close. 3.5. Why is that significant? Ooh. See what's happening? 1,260 days is the same as 42 months, which is the same as 3.5 years, which is half of 7. Symbolically, it means much more than counting days. We'll get to that later. The point point is, we do this all the time. This isn't anything new that we're interacting with Revelation. Symbols try to communicate to us on different levels at all times, just like what he's doing here. For example, why is it? Well, let me just grab your hat here for a minute. What is this?
MLB.
How do you know? Because you've seen it before. Do you know how many millions and billions of dollars every single year is spent so that whenever you see a symbol, you can know what the symbol stands for? Do you have any idea? Why? Why do they do that? Because symbols communicate to you on a deeper level than maybe you even recognize. We do this in the church, yeah? I mean, my word. Is this just two sticks lopped together accidentally to us? Is that what this is? What is this? What does it mean? Resurrection. What is it? What does it mean to you? Sacrifice. What else? Is that it?
It's an ethic.
What else?
A purpose.
What else?
It's Jesus.
What else?
Remembrance.
What else?
Victory.
This is what defines who we are. But it's just two pieces of wood slapped together. Shane, don't get bent all out of shape. If somebody decides to put it in feces and call it art, don't get bent out of shape. It's just two pieces of wood slapped together. No, it's not. This is my big beef with the Lord's Supper. For all that the Enlightenment has done good for us, it has done bad for us. It's destroyed the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is just a cognitive thing now, where we sit there and we just think about the things that we've done wrong, and then we eat a little chiclet and drink out of a shot glass, and that's it. That's not what it was meant to be. Do we not remember the debate that was happening between the Catholics and the Reformers? At the impetus of the Enlightenment, do we remember the debate? Transubstantiation and consubstantiation. It was never a debate of whether or not Jesus was there or not. It was how was he there? Was he actually the body and the blood that was actually turned into him? Or was he just present at the table? But what we have done 500 years removed is we act like he's not really there at all anymore. Is that it's just become a midday snack. That's all it's become. But symbols stand for so much more. They have so much power. They actually, I will even say this, they actually have an impact on the spiritual realm, things that you can't see. We can talk about this some other later, but I wish we were more Catholic in this area, to be honest with you. We would understand exorcisms a little better. Bottom line is that holy water does work. I don't know how to explain that. People that are possessed, when they come into contact with crucifixes, it does freak them out. And I don't know how to explain that. Point is this, symbols just aren't, they aren't just symbols. The Lord's Supper isn't just the Lord's Supper. It's not just something you sit there and just remember and go, ho-hum. Jesus is more present in that moment than in any other moment of your entire life. Shane, is that saying something about his omnipresence? I don't care about your Greek philosophy categories. I don't care. He is more present in that moment than in any other moment. And that's just the way the church has always believed. Until the last 100 years or so. Symbols do more. They take us to a different level. They communicate on a level that is beyond words. They are more powerful than what we can even comprehend. And that is the way Revelation is written all throughout. And if you take them literally, we talked about this last time, if we take them surface level, Revelation will contradict itself all the time. I don't have time to get into the one example I had today, but it'll come up some other time, I'm sure. Something, though, that I think it was Natalia and I were talking about at the end of last class, and this is my other point of why this symbol talk in Revelation is so important. It's because this is the way that God communicates himself throughout the entire Bible. This is nothing new. How does Well, describe to me some symbols that we have in the Bible for God. Yell out some. Father. Ark of the Covenant was a symbol for him, yes. His presence, anyway. What?
Fire.
The burning bush. What else?
Whisper.
The whisper, the gentle whisper.
Rock.
A rock.
Fortress,
my refuge. The good shepherd. You know, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not mind. He makes me walk in the green pastures. Symbolism. This is the way he communicates who he is. God can't just say, this is whom I am, in a didactic statement and us go, oh, that makes total sense. It doesn't happen that way. As much as we want it to happen that way, God can't fit in a logical syllogism. It just can't happen. But symbols get us about as close as our language allows us to get. He is a shepherd. He is king. He is fire. What about Jesus? Did he communicate to who he was through symbols? What?
I am statements
in John. I am the vine. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. I am the gate. I am the bread of life. I am the resurrection. I am everything. John the Baptist in the book of John says, behold, the Lamb of God who comes to take away the sins of the world. This is nothing new. How does Paul describe the church?
Bride.
The bride, what else? The body, what else?
Temple.
The temple. This is the way that we function in every facet of the New Testament. God communicates not only who He is, but who we are constantly through symbols. Yet we come to Revelation and we think we've got to throw all that out. It makes no sense. Allow the symbols to do what they've always done. And that is to impact us in a way that communicates deeper than what words can. Let's do this though, because there are some things we need to deal with symbols. What do these symbols mean? I want you just to simply yell them out whenever you see them. Yell them out, loud as you possibly can. Just kidding, kind of. Go.
Money. Jesus. Chevy. McDonald's.
Obesity.
Stop. Taco Bell. Pontiac. Peace. Nazis.
Hey! Now that's
2006 German World Cup.
Yeah. Do you hear that? The 2006 German World Cup. Now what's interesting about this is this. There's only two people that even came close to it in this classroom, and yet it is the world's most popular sport.
I know people keep saying what's a big deal with soccer? Since when has it been a big deal? Such a big deal.
Oh yeah. For example, I was over in Cairo, Egypt. I was over in Cairo, Egypt during the 2002 World Cup. And I'm not kidding. All I wanted to do was to buy a drink from a stand. That's all I wanted to do. I was like, man, I just want a Sprite. That's all I want. And he would not serve me because the World Cup was on. He wouldn't serve me. I was like, bro, you're running a business. And he's like, I don't care. He's like, I'm watching the World Cup. And that's the way the world works when the World Cup goes. I was thankful that I got out of the United Kingdom this past summer in time for whenever we had quite a little good bout against the English team. Because, man, I didn't want to be an American over there because they just take it seriously. However, if you don't have that context, this symbol means nothing to you. So what about this one?
Sports.
Council of Egypt.
Okay, so we're piecing some things together.
National Sports Council of Egypt.
Close.
No, that's for
kind of.
Ballet.
Here it is. It is the symbol for the National Bridge Club of Egypt. That is sponsored by the National Sports Council of Egypt. How come you didn't know that?
You can't read it?
Maybe it's because even these symbols in and of themselves, because you know all words are symbols, right? Isn't that true? Isn't every word actually a symbol that points to something beyond itself? For example, this. What does that do for you? Does it not conjure up something in your mind? But guess what? What's conjured up in your mind is going to be different than your mind, and different in your mind. Why? Because your contexts vary, right? Even words are symbols, and because you can't read these symbols, you can't piece together what this is. So, how do we deal with symbols when we come to the book of Revelation? How do we deal with it? Answer, Context, context, context. But I'm actually saying that three different ways. Context, lowercase c, context, capital C, context, all capital letters. Three different ways. Context, context, context. Even that, you needed context in order to understand how I was defining the words context. No, three's good enough. First one, lowercase c, context. The first question you ask when you come to a symbol in Revelation is how is it being used in the immediate contexts, the verses that come before and after, because symbols can change even within a couple of verses. Now I know in principles of interpretation you've heard something a little bit different than that, but the problem is that isn't the way language works all the time. Turn with me to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. A big rapture passage, which you guys will listen to that, and I won't go into the rapture stuff with this because I have a different point. A point that I think is closer to what Paul was trying to make, but whatever. We are going to look at the symbol asleep in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 13 and following. Brothers, we do not want you to be ignorant about those who fall asleep. What is that a symbol for right now? Death. How do you know? What?
Because before it says some of you have fallen asleep.
Does it? Say, I think verse 13 is the very first time it pops up at this point. However, you understand how language works and that makes sense to you. Right? Brothers, you just intuitively know that he's probably not talking about, we don't want you to be ignorant about the way in which people go to sleep at night. I mean, do we really think that's what he's talking about? No, intuitively we know he's talking about something deeper, right? Brothers, we do not want you to be ignorant about those who fall asleep or to grieve. Now all of a sudden you realize it is death context. To grieve like the rest of men who have no hope. We believe that Jesus died and rose again, and so we believe that God will bring with Jesus those who have fallen asleep in him. Now what else do we know about this symbol? It's not just dead people. Who is it?
Christians.
Dead Christians. Because they are the ones that will come. They are in Jesus. They're coming with him. According to the Lord's own word, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left till the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep. How do we use that word? Christians that have died in Jesus, right? Verse 16. For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, so much for a secret rapture, with the voice of the archangel and with the trumpet call of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. After that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with him in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. The word meet there is so awesome. And so we will be with the Lord forever. Therefore, encourage each other with these words. Okay, now let's keep reading because the word asleep is going to come up several more times. Now, brothers, about times and dates, we don't need to write to you. Oh, I wish we would actually take his advice there. For you know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. In other words, you can't predict it. There's no point in trying. While people are saying peace and security, or as Rome would put it, pax et securitas. While people are saying peace and security, destruction will come on them suddenly as labor pains on a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. But you, brothers, are not in darkness, so that this day should surprise you like a thief. You are all sons of the light and sons of the day. We do not belong to the night or to the darkness. So then let us not be like others who are asleep. Whoa. Now is that talking about dead Christians? What is it talking about? What's that? Outsiders that are living in sin. But the last time it was used to describe dead Christians. How do we know that it now means something totally different? Because you're right, but how do we know?
The verse context.
Context. Why? Because every word's meaning is only found in its context. So then let us not be like others who are asleep, but let us be alert and self-controlled. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk at night. But since we belong to the day, let us be self-controlled, putting on faith and love as a breastplate, and the hope of salvation as a helmet. For God did not appoint us to suffer wrath, but to receive salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ. He died for us so that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live together with him. Now what does that mean? whether we are dead or alive, we will spend time with him in eternity. See what happened? It switched meanings. Without even him saying, I'm switching symbols. He doesn't do that. He just moves. Why? Because we have the context in which we can interpret it because we understand how he's progressing. Yes? First thing you do when you come to a symbol is read the immediate context. How is it being used? And that will give you a context of how you can define it. If that does not prove to be fruitful, you move to the second realm of context, capital C context. And that is, you see how the word is being used in the entire book. For example, and I'm going to have to go through this quick because we're running out of time. The word key in the book of Revelation is only used four times, and it is not used anywhere close to itself every time it is used. The word key. First time it is used is in Revelation chapter 1, verse 18. And I suggest that because it is only used four times, it is not close to itself in the immediate context, that this is the one, this first one is helps us define the rest of them. Now that sounds more like principles of interp, right? Chapter 1, verse 18, Jesus says, I am the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. What is he referring to?
Power.
Power? Yes. Think about a key. Just normally, think about a key. It stands for power and authority, because the only people that have my key to my house are the ones that I, as the one that has authority over the house, have given them a key. Right? Because I am the one that is sovereign over that house in the sense of ownership, not in the sense of dominating my wife and things of weirdness like that. You see what I mean by that? Keys, I have keys to my office. And only other people that are authorized by the proper authorities have the authority to have a key to my office. You don't. Right? Keys symbolize authority, power, sovereignty. Jesus has the keys of what? Death and Hades. How did he get those? How did he conquer them? The cross and the resurrection. The key in 1:18 is defined as the sovereignty and the authority of Jesus attained at the resurrection. Okay? So, chapter 3, verse 7 is the next time the word key comes about. Jesus says, these are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What should I interpret the symbol of key as? The sovereignty and authority attained at the resurrection. The sovereignty and authority of Jesus attained at the resurrection. Chapter 9, verse 1, the fifth trumpet sounds. It says, I saw a star that had fallen from the sky to the earth. The star was given the key to the shaft of the abyss. He was given what? Sovereignty and authority that was attained at the resurrection by Jesus. He has the power over it and the power to divvy it out to who he desires, whom he desires. Chapter 20, verse 1. This is where the rubber meets the road, ladies and gentlemen. Because chapter 20, verse 1 is the beginning of what famous chapter? The millennium. And I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss and holding in his hand a great chain. How do I define the word key there? The sovereignty and authority attained at the resurrection by Jesus. To which I suggest, chapter 20, verse 1 tells us this is happening at the resurrection. We'll get to that though later. Point is, if the symbol in immediate context cannot help you in determining what it is, you move to the book context. And then you can start to see how the book or how the symbol functions throughout the whole book, therefore helping you in the areas where it's not clear. Okay? Final answer. If none of that helps, you move to all capital letters context, which is not the rest of the New Testament, the Old Testament. Why would I say something that audacious? Say it again?
Because Revelation's so dependent on the New Testament.
Yeah. Out of 404 verses in the book of Revelation, there are over 516 Old Testament allusions according to my count. Let that sink in. In 404 verses, there are over 516 allusions to the Old Testament. That means every verse contains something about the Old Testament. Now, can I make a statement that'll kind of pull together some of the things we've been talking about and wrestling with? Do you want to know why people can get away with so many ridiculous interpretations of Revelation today? We don't know our Old Testaments. It's as simple as that. It's as simple as that. You want to know why Hal Lindsey can get away with saying that the locusts in Revelation 9, hopefully you got that right on your what chapter quiz, the locusts in Revelation 9 are Apache helicopters? Is because no one has ever raised their hand and said, but what about Joel 2? I mean, doesn't that make an impact? Do you want to know why people can get away with these ludicrous things? It's because we don't know our Old Testaments enough to tell them otherwise. We look at Revelation and all we see is an image of the National Bridge Company in the National Bridge Club in Egypt. That's all we see. Because the symbols don't mean anything to us. Because we don't have our Old Testaments in place to be able to understand what they mean. We don't get it. Why would John, answer me this question, why would John saturate his book so much with the Old Testament? Why would he do that?
Because that was their Bible.
That was his Bible. Can you lead people to Christ with just using the Old Testament? You should, because that's all the early church was using. They didn't have a Roman road. They had Isaiah and Daniel and Ezekiel. This is how he taught these people in Asia Minor. And this is the story that they stand in. He is saying that what was begun in Genesis chapter 3 when they were kicked out of the garden has been redeemed through Jesus, and we stand in that heritage. Therefore, it makes sense that whenever he's talking about the seven church, or talking about the Christians on earth in chapter 7, he describes the 12,000 and the 12 tribes, although he replaces one. Why? Because that's us. We are the fulfilled Israel. We don't replace anything. We are the continuation of that which was begun and brought to its climax in Jesus. It's not replacement theology, it's fulfillment theology. We, our forefathers, I will say this, sorry. My forefathers are not Thomas Jefferson. It's not John Quincy Adams, George Washington. My forefathers are Abraham, Isaac, and Moses. That's my people. That's who I am. And whenever I'm in times of persecution, that's what needs to be beaten into my mind. Who am I? Who do I belong to? What are the cloud of witnesses that define who I am? Who are they? Do you want to know? Do you know that over 150 allusions belong to the Exodus alone? Why would that be a big book to pull from? The very first time that an empire had God's people under oppression and they were longing for God to move to bring them in Exodus. And He did. We don't know our Old Testaments, therefore we do with Revelation whatever we want. However, I suggest if we pay attention to our Old Testaments, it'll be a little bit harder to abuse the book. Which is why one of your assignments is to look at your chapter, all the Old Testament allusions. Even the weird ones like the two witnesses become very clear whenever you look at the Old Testament. We're not done yet. We have a little bit. There are dangers in interpreting symbols. Let me give you two of them. First is this. Do not read your culture back into the symbols and think you've interpreted the symbol accurately. Okay? Don't look at a symbol, read your culture back into it and think, yeah, that's what the symbol means. For example, the cross. The cross in our day and age is much different than their day and age, right? How would a Roman look at this?
Death.
Yes, death to political revolutions that have failed. How would a Jew look at this, says Deuteronomy? For one who hangs on a tree is cursed by God. So don't think that every time the word cross is being used, like in Matthew, whenever Jesus says, anyone that is to follow me is to pick up his cross and then come follow me. Guess what? Whenever he said that, it didn't mean salvation yet. Think about that. When Jesus first said that statement, if anyone is to come follow me, he must first take up his cross and then come follow me. It didn't mean salvation yet, because he hadn't died on the cross yet. What it meant was, come join a failed revolution that is so radical that I'm going to be telling you things that you think you will even be cursed by God if you follow me. But I'm telling you, this is the way of righteousness. You got to let the symbols say what they mean when they're actually being said. And don't read what you think it means back into it. Final thing is this. Don't miss the forest by focusing on one tree. Don't miss the entire forest because you're so focused on one tree. Symbols are very tempting that you focus on one symbol and then you miss the whole picture. For example, what do you see here? What is this? What is that?
A blur.
A blur? Yeah, that's a pretty good guess. What's okay, let me zoom out. What is this?
A hand.
A hand. Very, very job well done. Let's zoom out a little bit more. What is this?
An arm.
Let's zoom out. What is this? It's my daughter. When we very first began this, you're focused in on her little hand. And if that's all you were focused on, you'd be missing the whole picture. But the more you zoom out, the more you actually see the picture clearly. It is very tempting for us to look at one little symbol and think that we understand what he's saying in Revelation. But you have to take the symbol and see how it is functioning in the whole stream of the river that is running in throughout the 22 chapters. Otherwise, you think you have the picture, but you don't actually have it. Because it is not just a little blur, it's not just a hand, it's not just an arm, it actually isn't just even a little girl. Because if I zoom out one more time, we are trying to get a family picture and she is refusing to come sit by us. You see what I mean? This picture, she looks idyllic. She looks wonderful, innocent, and pure. But she's actually being quite devious in this moment. As you can see on my face, I'm not too happy. And my wife saying, why won't you come over here? If you focus on one symbol, you can miss the whole point of the book of Revelation. What is 666? What is 666? You're missing the point. When is the 1,000 years coming? You're missing the point. You're going to miss the whole picture because you're focusing on one tree. We're at a time. I do want to leave you, though, with these two statements. Let's try to focus on the forest by using the Old Testament. And if you don't do either one of those, you can sell a lot of books and make a lot of money. Love you guys. Have a good week. End and week. I will see you not next week, but the week after.